Hello everyone, hello football fans around the world. Welcome to the Squawker Talker, the Friday Squawker Talker. And my word is there are lots to talk about, lots of Premier League midweek action and lots going on in the news. Let's kick off by talking about West Ham 0, Man City 4. I'm joined today by Oliver Young-Miles. Hello, Ollie.
Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very good.
Fantastic. Also joining us from the Daily Mirror is football journalist Adrian Kajumba. Hello, Adrian. How's it going?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. Always a pleasure to have you on. And also joining us is Rory Briggs. Hello, Rory.
Hello. Good to be back again.
Yeah?
I don't know if you've seen my one-on-one series as well, which is also going.
Shameless.
There we go. Every other Wednesday.
Shameless.
But I'm here today, so yeah, one for the team.
I don't know why I'm saying shameless. I work on them.
I know.
Let's get straight into it. Ollie, Man City battered West Ham again.
Yeah, they did.
We didn't see this coming, but what everyone's talking about is that front four for Man City. Kevin De Bruyne, Leroy Sané, Raheem Sterling and Gabriel Jesus. That looks like the future of Man City, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was terrifying to watch, I think, for anyone who doesn't support Man City. It was kind of the game, you know, Man City against Spurs a couple of weeks ago, we sort of saw the Guardiola's point is starting to get across, and then it was, you know, they were unlucky not to win that. And they took that into the West Ham game and just blew them away completely. The pace, the movement, the technique as well of that front four was just devastating, and West Ham couldn't deal with it. And, you know, it's starting to look as if City are finally, you know, getting to where Pep wants them to be.
Adrian, everyone's talking about Gabriel Jesus. I mean, he's gotten an assist. He got an assist in his first debut in his first game against Crystal Palace, and he got two assists and a goal yesterday. He looks like he's taken to the Premier League like a duck to water instantly, doesn't he?
Yeah, I was at the Crystal Palace game on Saturday, actually. And I think one of the things that you always look for when a foreign player comes into English football is maybe how they deal with the physical side of it. And I think that was one thing about Gabriel Jesus that really stood out against Crystal Palace. A lot of tracking back, not afraid to get stuck in himself, go out for the aerial challenges, even though he's not the biggest himself. And, you know, I was amazed watching them on Saturday at Crystal Palace and just thinking of the foresight on City's behalf to get those three and get them now at a stage where, although, as Guardiola says, they've only got an average age of 20, they look so ready. They actually look like they could play week on week on week, rather than some clubs who've got younger players, like, you know, drop them in, take them out for a little while. These three actually look ready. And another thing I forgot, actually, on Saturday is they've actually got Kelechi Iheanacho as well to chuck into this mix as well,
who's... Yeah.
Incredible young player, great record, great ratio of finishing and turning sort of minutes into goals, really. So it's really, really exciting for City's future.
Rory, what does this say, what does yesterday's performance say about the future of Sergio Aguero at Man City? Because he's been so reliable and talismanic for them in the past. He hasn't really fit in Guardiola's system. He came on and actually looked pretty ponderous for them, whereas... Yeah. Jesus's movement seemed to tally so well with what De Bruyne, Sterling and Sané offer.
Well, it is weird that a player of his calibre has been made obsolete in a team like City who need to go for the title. And Guardiola still said, oh, he's going to be very important. But at the same time, he's saying, well, this is the future for 3 or 4 years with this front three. And he's also said, you know, about Jesus, you know, if you look into a watermelon to see how good it is, and he's seen how good Jesus is. You know, what's he seeing in Aguero right now? Is it some sort of off fruit? I mean, what's going on? Yeah, he's got, oh, that's part of the sell-by date, yeah. So, I don't know, yeah, but for... And there was also that brilliant camera shot after Jesus' goal, his celebration, pan to Aguero just looking on in disbelief almost.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long a player like that can really sort of continue it if that's his situation.
Aguero's obviously got an incredible goal-scoring record in this country, but what happens is when... Aguero's obviously had his problems with fitness and suspension, but he's always been able to come back into the side because City have been waiting for him. But now with Gabriel Jesus, they look like they've actually got somebody who can genuinely challenge him. Whether that will then change the way Aguero is with these suspensions, maybe he won't be quite as reckless when he's going into challenges and getting involved in things off the ball, and maybe all of a sudden, who knows, his injury record might clear up. You look at Wilshere, he's gone away, and you know, now he's under a bit of pressure. All of a sudden he can stay fit. So maybe that will change with Aguero, but I think now he's got a real challenge.
I think the thing for Aguero is, you know, this is the first time in his City career that he's suddenly, you know, really, you know, in danger of losing his place. I think when City played Barcelona early in the season, he was dropped, and I think that was the first time in his City career he'd been dropped. And they played De Bruyne as a sort of false nine. Didn't really work. And there wasn't, as good as Iheanacho is, he wasn't able to sort of step into that sort of game. With Jesus coming in, we've seen already that he can lead the line for City already. He's been electric up front.
Guardiola also said that they could play in the front two at some point. Yeah, they didn't rule that
they
out.
They're quite similar.
Poor defense. Yeah. He's got to deal with those two.
Especially with Kevin De Bruyne behind them. Open question, guys. What does it say for City's title hopes? You know, they are quite far off the pace, but that if they can put together the sort of streak that they did at the beginning of the season, is there a chance for them? And Chelsea are very far in front.
It's going to be tough for them, but they've had a good week in that they're the only ones in the top six that have actually won. So they're the only team that's made ground. I'd still say Chelsea have been big winners this week just because everyone else has dropped points. But if City, if they can put together a run of form, they'll climb that table. But you look at Chelsea's lead and it's massive at the moment at this stage of the season.
Looks pretty insurmountable. Adrian, what about West Ham? An absolute caning, similar to the one they got in the FA Cup from City. Has the Payet-less bubble burst? Because they were sort of riding that wave of enthusiasm. They hung Payet out to dry for having the temerity to take a wage cut and go to his boyhood club.
Where your views are. I'll see which side of the fence you're on the Payet issue.
Yeah, my French heritage has nothing to do with that. That's a bit of a shock to the system for Bitch's side because they've been playing all right recently.
They have the Payet issue really galvanised them as a squad. And, you know, the fans as well. So as a whole club, I think it really united West Ham, gave them a bit of a cause to fight for. You know, they're obviously in a corner with Payet and, you know, they came out fighting. But I don't think it particularly burst the bubble. You know, I think City, the way they played last night and obviously the way West Ham had already seen them in the Cup, West Ham know how good City can be. I think it's just a case of, you know, dust yourselves down after last night, just get back on the horse and go again. You know, they were making positive steps, you know, in the wake of the Payet incident and revelations from Bilic. So I think they just got to, you know, pick themselves up, dust themselves down, just go again.
Rory, West Ham have got Southampton away next, who we've just heard have lost defender Virgil van Dijk for 3 months, so effectively most of the rest of the season. Andy Carroll will be licking his lips at facing Maya Yoshida, you'd think.
Although saying that, Yoshida had a great game recently. I can't remember who it was
against. Liverpool,
yeah. And that is, I mean, even Southampton fans were pretty surprised about that. But yeah, that is a open invitation for Andy Carroll. And, you know, he's going to have that mural in his mind as well, replacing Pie at the stadium, which was an odd choice, I thought. I think, you know, as a club thinking, oh, let's just put whoever recently scored.
Yeah. Who scored recently? Yeah, oh, Andy Carroll.
It was a good goal.
It was a good goal.
It was a top goal. Jose Font going back to the Dale. Yeah. So St. Mary's even, sorry.
Yeah.
Going back to 1996.
I mean, he must be just thinking, what have I done? He's left a club where he's captain and, you know, a real leader, real fans' favourite for 6-7 years. To go to West Ham, obviously he's getting more money there, but he's missing out on a cup final place, which just seems bizarre.
Also playing in front of fans that left the stadium last night at a critical rate past the 55th minute.
Yeah, I fear for him this weekend. I think he's in for a
tumultuous reception.
Yeah, not a great reception, I don't think, for him, though.
It's a strange one, you know. He fought his way out for not that much money, apparently. I don't think the pay rise was as much as you might have thought he would have got. And, you know, missing the cup final. And then last week, after Southampton got there, you got the story breaking about them potentially having a big investment from China. So, you know, you wonder if he's left a club who are going to rebuild and, you know, keep climbing as they have done over the last few years. So, looks a bit of a strange decision for Font.
Adrian, quickly, City have got Swansea at home. That this must be a regulation win. I mean, Paul Clement's side they seem to be pulling a rabbit out of a hat to get out of the relegation zone, and all credit to them. But City are a very strong side, in good form. Do you expect a regulation home win?
In normal circumstances, I would have said yes, but I have been quite impressed by how Swansea have been under Clement. Obviously, back-to-back wins for the first time this season following their win against Southampton. So he's obviously doing something there, and in terms of them going away to big clubs, obviously they've just gone to Liverpool and just won 3-2. So, you know, that's a template there for them when they go to City. You expect City to win, but maybe not as comfortably as they might have done a month ago, say.
Interesting. Let's talk a bit about Man United 0, Hull 0. Rory, United stay sixth. That's 102 days in sixth place now. Or is it 103 today? I'm not sure. Great point for Marco Silva's Hull, though. Hull, like Paul Clement Swansea, look absolutely revitalised. Is safety a possibility for them somehow, by some miracle?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I think especially after the reception that his appointment received in this country from, you know, people I'm not going to name, but prominent pundits who, you know, gave him a proper battering.
We know who you're talking about.
You know, basically attacked his CV, saying he's not up for it. He doesn't know the Premier League, and he's gone right out and shown them exactly how he's, you know, what he's capable of, with a very limited sort of pool of talent. But I think getting Niasse in is interesting because he actually was a physical specimen that can deal with players, other teams. And Markovic nearly scored against United. Mm. So, yeah, I think Hull is better, but I think they're still going to go down.
Yeah. Ollie, it's the same story for United when they drop points. Mm. It feels like they've been sixth for years, although it is just 103 days, or 102. They create tons and tons of chances, and they can't put them away. Pogba missed a sitter, Ibrahimovic missed a couple of chances, Mata missed an absolutely gilt-edged chance. Mm. I mean, it's funny, when Ibrahimovic doesn't score, they don't really have anyone stepping up from midfield who's getting the goals for them. And they're benching Martial, who's arguably the second-best finisher at the club.
I think the worrying thing for them is they seem to have overcome this sort of mental block that they had where they couldn't break down teams. You know, we've started to see, you know, they're grinding out results recently, but this is like the Man United we saw in sort of September, October, when they were suffering home draws against the likes of Burnley and well, even though Arsenal are a great side, they should have beaten Arsenal as well. And that's the troubling thing for them. If they'd won, they would have been right up in the in contention for top four, because the gap isn't that big anymore between two and six. And yeah, it's just another frustrating day for them. It's strange, and you would have thought as well they would have learned from playing Hull in the EFL Cup when they lost 2-1 that, you know, they're a different beast under Silva, and they still couldn't put them away, which is you know, obviously very, very disappointing for Mourinho.
One player, Adrian, who could help Man United with putting away all those chances is Antoine Griezmann, who's been heavily linked this morning by the French press with a move to Man United. What are your thoughts on that deal actually coming to be? And B, what sort of place would he take at United? Is it a straight up Ibrahimovic replacement? Would he play out wide? I mean, it would be a fascinating transfer to work under Mourinho.
It would be, because it's going to be a lot of money again, so everyone will be looking at Manchester United probably making the headline signing this summer. Mm. I think it's been coming for some time. I mean, even if you go back and trace back to last summer when Diego Simeone changed his contract situation there, and Griezmann's future was quite interlinked with that. It was almost like the wheels were in motion then for him to possibly be leaving. Mm. Manchester United, as we know, got loads of money. There's a lot of confidence, a lot of nudging and winking if you speak to people at United about, you know, their interest in Griezmann and where they're going to go for him. So they're certainly going to go for him. Where he fits in, I would say, you know, when you look at where Rooney was playing at the start of the season, you know, you'd look at him as a Rooney replacement. But I think he gives United a few options, because he can play wide, he can play up front on his own, or he can play as a striker as he did for France. He can play in the number 10 role, the sort of role that was given to Rooney. So it gives United a lot of options, you know, if they do get that transfer over the line, as they seem to be quite confident that they will.
I think the issue with signing Griezmann is, you know, if they're going to spend a world record, which it looks like it's going to be, to get him, you need to play him in his best position, which I think is playing off a big, big, strong player like Ibrahimovic in that sort of second striker role. But if United do that, they're going to have to go to 4-2-3-1, which brings another issue, which is, how do you get the best out of Pogba? Mm. So it's going to be interesting, if he does come, where Mourinho sees him. And it's looking at it from outside, it seems like United are going down a similar route to Real Madrid in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, just buying big names and hoping it works rather than getting players to fit an actual system.
Yeah, very good point. Rory, looking more at the short term, should Mourinho be seriously worried about not getting Champions League this season? I mean, he was really brought in to confirm Champions League status. They spent a big old whack of money to make sure that Mourinho gets Champions League football, and it's slipping further and further away.
And they are 5 points behind fifth place. So I think, you know, looking at that, they're going to be worried. Mourinho also is worried. He said this week that he's missing Champions League football. Man United deserve to be in there. He said they belong in that tournament. So, and if they want to attract, you know, the players that they should be attracting, then they're going to need to be in there for, you know, not only players, but commercial reasons as well, despite being the richest, well, the highest earners in world football at the moment. So, yeah, I think he's worried. And you look at the teams above them, there's no reason to think that they're going to slip off.
They've got Leicester away this weekend. Is that a must-win? Otherwise, they probably have to say bye-bye to Champions League spot.
I think a draw will be okay. But also, I think that Leicester's shocking form, so I think they'll manage it. Leicester only five wins all season, I think. Mm. One of them, though, was a surprise win against City at home. So who knows? You know, that might be a repeat of that. Mm. They're going to need it.
Ollie, Hull have got Liverpool at home. Mm. Perceivably quite an angry Liverpool side if you watch that Chelsea game. Probably not an ideal opponent for Hull next, is it?
No, but they seem to have this remarkable resilience at the moment since Silva's come in. Everything about that club, you'd suggest, you know, they'd be going down. There's been this issue off the field all season. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, this window, they've lost their two best players in Jake Livermore and Robert Snodgrass, and were sort of scrambling around on deadline day, getting, you know, loans in from, you know, wherever across Europe. But it's somehow working for them. You know, they've picked up form. And Liverpool won't fancy playing them, especially after they got a draw against United as well. Liverpool, I think, showed signs of coming back to, you know, what we expect from them against Chelsea. But, yeah, it's going to be an interesting game. Liverpool need to pick up a win. Otherwise, we can write off their title chances now, I think. Mm. And Hull obviously needs to keep this momentum wherever it's coming from. They need to keep it going.
Wherever it's coming from. Adrian, one final game that was in midweek. Stoke 1, Everton 1. Not exactly, you know, defining potentially the earliest dead rubber of the season. But a word on Everton. They're now comfy in seventh place. Potential Europa League, depending on how the cup wins work out. Man United win the League Cup. Maybe there's another top four club in the FA Cup final. You have to say, what were Everton fans so worried about? Ronald Koeman's put them exactly pretty much where they want to be.
Yeah, things were picked up of late, but I must admit they were on a bit of a dodgy run for a little while, so I can understand why they're worried. I think it's one win in 11 they were on at one stage, but things have picked up lately. Tom Davies looks like a nice, lively introduction to their team, and obviously he's an academy product as well, which always helps. A couple of signings in Lookman and Schneiderlin in January. Lookman's obviously already had an impact on his debut, and Schneiderlin will do. He's a very solid player. Mm. Very impressive at Southampton, not so at Manchester United, but, you know, he'll be aiming to revive his career at Everton. So this recent form and you know, the morale boost of the new signings, I think Everton are in a good place right now.
Yeah, Rory, Adrian mentioned Morgan Schneiderlin completed 96% of his passes yesterday. Most tackles, most blocks on the pitch. Mm. Looked pretty much man of the match. He instantly delivered the sort of performance that we kind of knew he could.
Yeah, he's definitely a great signing for them against and also alongside Idrissa Gueye. That's a formidable midfield there, very balanced. And also nice to see him after the game giving Tom Davies a bit of sort of instructions about positioning, movement, things like that. So I think he's going to become a leader for them as well as that. So yeah.
Speaking of leaders, Peter Crouch.
Peter Crouch.
100 not out. And he busted out the robot. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, he's sort of a flashback to his greatest hits, really. But he... Yeah, no, great, great player. You know, an honour to really watch him over the years. But I'm actually quite excited to see him and Berahino, his little and large duo, going forward. Good, you never know. Yeah.
The ultimate little and large.
A little throwback to Crouch and Defoe.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it will be interesting to see those two and to see Berahino playing football again.
Yeah.
And see how long and how quickly he can, you know, how long it takes him, sorry, to get back to the form he showed early on in his West Brom career.
Stoke and Everton, Ollie, both unbeaten in 2017. Both look very much like solid top half sides. Stoke, let's talk a bit about Stoke, actually. Mm-hmm. Mark Hughes has taken Stoke, basically, when he took over, they were 13th, 14th for about three or four seasons in a row. And it looks like they're going to be ninth again this season, third season in a row, ninth, eighth or ninth. Does he deserve credit for that? Because it's not that easy in the Premier League to go from top end of the bottom half to creeping up to the... To the higher echelons of the Premier League.
Yeah, I think he does. I think this season they've been pretty much flat track bullies, really. They've beaten sort of lesser sides, but the fact that they're in the top half when a lot of clubs below them are spending a lot more money than they are. You look at Crystal Palace spending, you know, 50 odd million in the summer and another 30 odd in this window. Mm. And they're, you know, miles behind Stoke really in terms of points and where they're at. So I think Hughes does deserve credit. You know, Stoke are never going to be challenging for Europe, I don't think, but they've sort of cornered that 8th to 10th position in the Premier League. That's theirs at the moment. And, you know, their consistency, they deserve credit for that.
I think Mark Hughes, you know, just to repeat the point, he does obviously deserve more credit and maybe more attention than he's getting. But it's quite interesting speaking to people at Stoke. I think Mark Hughes is actually not that bothered about how much attention he gets and how much praise he gets. He just wants to get on and do the job. Mm. And I think if you look at some of the jobs he's had in the past, or certainly, you know, more recently before the Stoke job, Man City, and even QPR, even though where they were in the table, is a job that attracted quite a lot of attention because it's a bit of a soap opera of a club. And I think he's probably just happy to be at a club where, in some ways, people aren't shining a spotlight on what he's doing all the time and what he does achieve and the way he's transformed Stoke slowly in terms of the players there that he's bringing in and the positions he's moving them up on the table. It's just speaking for itself. There's no sort of fuss around what he's doing. So I think Mark Hughes is actually quite happy with that.
They're facing West Brom this weekend, 8th versus 9th. Tony Pulis derby, as they're calling it.
Sido-Berahino derby.
Sido-Berahino derby. What do you reckon to that? What do you reckon is going to be the outcome of that?
I'm going to sit on the fence and go draw.
Okay.
I'm going to sit on the fence and go draw. Just West Brom having a home. Yeah. Risky. Just with West Brom having home advantage. I know Tony Pulis would love to win that. I don't think... I'm trying to say this carefully, but I don't think everything is, you know, there's a great relationship between him and his old club. Mm. I think there was a little bit of tension in the Berahino negotiations, for example. So he'd certainly love to get one over Stoke. But Stoke are doing well at the moment as well, so that's why I'm sitting on the fence.
Well, that'll be interesting.
He does actually leave clubs under a bit of a cloud every time. I remember he left Gillingham, and Paul Scally, the chairman of Gillingham, a couple of years ago, was having an interview, and he said, he won't welcome him back in the stadium.
And there's obviously the court case with Palace as well.
Yeah. First time he left Stoke, it was very acrimonious, and to be forgiven. Watch out, Tony. Rory, Everton have got Bournemouth. They're definitely on the slide. And also, just before we came in, we heard that Callum Wilson has done his other ACL on his other leg, so he's out for the rest of the season, which is terrible news. You'd expect Everton to kind of just they've got so many goals in them, and Bournemouth just they concede so many goals, it's a recipe for disaster for the South Coast.
It's weird because you'd be thinking Lukaku would be taking full advantage of this, but he only had one shot on target the whole game against Stoke, which is a bit of a surprise. But I mean, he is a streaky striker, but I think it's going to be a different game with Bournemouth, and also they've kind of fallen off since that 3-3 draw against Arsenal. You're thinking, oh, they're going to go on here and, you know, use that confidence and take, you know, take advantage of their attacking speed. But I think Callum Wilson as well is going to be a big miss for them. Benakofobi is decent, but he's not going to take them probably where the mid table security they want.
Watch out, Eddie Howe. Don't want to get relegated. So small infrastructure, that's the problem. They have a lot of big money to spend on the players. Let's look at the other Premier League games that are coming up this weekend, and obviously the big one. Woo, Ollie. Chelsea versus Arsenal, Stamford Bridge, obviously 3-0 at the Emirates. It was the catalyst for Conte sorting out Chelsea, because before then everyone was calling him a fraud and all these sort of things. A Juve manager who only got wins against peasants and all that sort of thing. One notable point is Arsenal don't have a midfield and Chelsea have the best midfielder in the league in N'Golo Kante.
Yep.
That's, you'd think, where this tie might be won and lost, because Arsenal looking like it's going to be Oxlade-Chamberlain and Francis Coquelin in midfield, who have pretty much never played together.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like every week we're talking about Arsenal's midfield, but that's because that is, you know, that's their area of issue at the moment. I actually quite like Oxlade-Chamberlain centre midfield, but when you compare him and Coquelin against a Kante and Matic partnership that have been so good, so consistently all season, it doesn't bode well for Arsenal. One thing I will say for them, though, is they can't play any worse than they did on Tuesday night. It was a shambles of a performance, really, against Watford after a game where they absolutely blitzed Southampton. So they will rally after that. It's a huge game for them. They need to win to stay in the title race. It'll be an interesting matchup with Chelsea, you know, coming off another good result for them against Liverpool.
Adrian, Wenger usually does well against a three at the back. That's how his sides generally do well against that. But Conte's counter-attack formation looks perfect to just absorb Arsenal's pressure and then hit them on the break, doesn't it?
I think there are back threes and then there are Conte's back three. And Conte's is very, very different to everyone else's in the sense of he seems to have nailed it. His players have nailed it. You look at what I find quite interesting is the number of teams who have tried to change the way they play when they come up against Chelsea. And it just doesn't work. So whatever he's doing and the way he's got it working with his players is almost, telepathic. They just know exactly what they're doing. You know, they know how to the transition from, you know, defence to attack and then back again. And the counter-attack, is frightening. When you see Chelsea switch and just burst when they regain possession, it's frightening. So, I mean, Wenger may well do well against back threes, but I'm not sure if he's come up against Chelsea. He wouldn't have come up against Conte's back three. So
in the second half, they changed to the back three. That's what prompted it.
So that's an interesting thing. I was having a look at how they did, because I was there for that game when Arsenal won 3-0 pretty convincingly. But in the second half, he changed it to a 3-4-3 for the first time this season. Obviously, they went on and they are where they are now after it. But in the first half, they only won 33% of their tackles, and then the second half switched 61%, and Arsenal basically, you know, couldn't really get. Had one shot on target for the rest in the second half.
Mm.
So as well as being able to hit them on the counter, Arsenal were pretty much suffocated as a result. So one for that, but also Coquelin in field, you know, that is going to be worrying, because he's only won 33% of his tackles this season, and he's going to be the one relying on to, you know, safeguard that defence, which is already looking pretty shaky after after Watford. I mean, people like Mustafi, who have been mainstays, and that was his first loss as an Arsenal player, but he looked shaky. And alongside Gabriel, who, to be fair to him, was good beforehand, but you know, he's no Bellerin. And every time it got to him out on the right, then the attack completely came to a sort of shuddering halt. Yeah,
and obviously since that day, Chelsea have had so much time to work on this system, so you can imagine that you can imagine how much more used to it they are, how much more comfortable they are with the system. Just going back to Arsenal's midfield, I was at Bournemouth in midweek watching Jack Wilshere put in another sort of strong performance. I know Bournemouth lost, but Jack Wilshere himself just taking, you know, his performance as an individual, looking a lot more stronger, a lot more comfortable, a lot more confident as well. And you're talking about Arsenal now having big gaps in their midfield, and the way that Chelsea brought back Ake from his loan midway through the season, it just makes the folly of Arsene Wenger not putting a recall clause in that Wilshere deal just look even more astounding, really.
He doesn't like his recall clauses. Ollie, one player who had an absolute nightmare of a game at the Emirates is Diego Costa. You can smart money would be to put a bet on him to get a goal, because he's got a great record against Arsenal in the past, a great record of getting their players sent off as well. He's going to be desperate to make it a bit of a nightmare for Koscielny and Mustafi, you'd expect.
Yeah, well, he's angry at the best of times, but I think having missed the penalty in midweek, he's going to be even more up for this game. I think even though he missed against Liverpool, he showed, I think, once again that he is just the perfect lone striker. There was a moment in the second half, ball came into him, he bounced Matip out of the way, just ran basically around the, you know, Liverpool's whole defence and got a cross in. He's unstoppable, I think, at the moment. And he'll be, if Troy Deeney can, you know, destroy Mustafi and
Gabriel really struggled,
then yeah, they're gonna have their work cut out against Costa, because he's on fire this season.
A quick word. Obviously announced today that Frank Lampard's retired from football, a Chelsea legend, undoubtedly. We were just doing an article before we came in, and it's ridiculous the number of players, some of the names that he's scored more league goals than, isn't it, Ollie?
Yeah. Yeah, he's ridiculous. You know, we were trying to think as well of goal-scoring midfielders, not necessarily number 10s or attacking midfielders, but actual central midfielders, box-to-box. There's not many like him, you know, and his record, I think, sort of flew under the radar a little bit. You know, he got 10 plus league goals every season, usually in the high teens as well. He was just a phenomenon, really. And he was the one that kick-started Chelsea's sort of golden era of success. He scored twice when they beat Bolton and secured their first Premier League title. And I've seen a lot on Twitter today as well of people saying he's their greatest ever player, which shows just how big an impact he had at that club.
I think one of the things that stood out for me just listening to what's been said, listening to and reading what's been said about Lampard since that announcement this morning, was just how hard he's worked for what he's got, and the amount of people saying what a great example he is for young players. You know, always staying back late after training, and just really setting the right example and being a real leader. So I think that really stands out, as well as all the accolades. You know, some players are born naturally gifted; they don't have to do that. But Frank Lampard is one of those who's worked at his craft, and he got the reward. So, you know, great career, and it'll be, in some ways it's sad that he's retired, but it'd be interesting to see now where he goes on to.
Also, while we were researching that Frank Lampard article, that we realised that Clarence Seedorf has scored as many career league goals as Kevin Nolan, which was a bit
Kevin
of a,
the Nolan, yeah.
Kevin the Nolan, which was a bit of a startling realization.
It was also going back to when he was at West Ham. Do you remember that interview, that press conference where
Brad Knapp sticks up for him?
Yeah, when he was told, he's never going to amount to anything, and now a legend in the game. So
Scott Cannon,
Ollie Street in there.
Is that the guy who
I think so.
Yeah. If you don't know what we're talking about, there's a clip. It's on YouTube. It's Harry Redknapp at a West Ham press conference destroying one of the supporters club who claims that Frank Lampard should be dropped, and it's just nepotism. Very, very entertaining. Spurs versus Middlesbrough. Ollie, we're talking about it again. Spurs' squad depth. Looks like 12 players, if they get top four, it's going to be off the back of 12 players, because it seems like after that 12th or 13th player in their squad, there's nobody there who's stepping up who's top four quality.
Yeah, it's basically the same issue as last season. They've bolstered that midfield with Wanyama, who's been an excellent addition. But otherwise, we're looking at last summer now as a disastrous one for the club. They brought, aside from Wanyama, three other players for £60 million. Vincent Janssen, Moussa Sissoko, and George Kevin Nkudu.
Sissoko is going to go down as one of the worst transfers in League history.
Him and Janssen.
In terms of value,
arguably at the moment.
When you consider his price tag as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's the issue for Spurs at the moment. Against Sunderland, I watched the game, and Sunderland, weren't very good. They weren't very adventurous. But the issue with Spurs is if their starting 11 can't break a team down, they've got nothing to come on, really. And if Dele Alli's not scoring, if Harry Kane's not scoring, if Eriksen's not on his game, and if the fullbacks aren't playing, which, with Danny Rose now being injured, is a huge issue, then Spurs, are a lot more limited. And it'll be the same for them this weekend against Borough. It'll be exactly the same game. Borough will sit back, soak up pressure, and, have the odd counter-attack. But Spurs need to find a way of, if plan A isn't working, getting plan B to work.
Mm. Cheeky bid for Aguero in the summer, maybe.
Aguero and Kane up front.
that's the problem. That's the problem for Spurs, isn't it? Trying to find, the way they play. Harry Kane is head and shoulders above probably any striker they could actually get. Whoever comes in is going to be playing second fiddle to Harry Kane. But then it's very difficult to find somebody who's willing to do that. So it looks like they'll be having the same problem in the summer.
Dele Alli's going to have to step up as well. Obviously he has done, but. Interesting to talk about Lampard again. Tim Sherwood told you in an interview recently, wasn't it? Mm. He could become the next Lampard.
Yeah. I think they're similar. I think Ali, last year we were sort of comparing him to Gerrard in that, he's sort of blood and thunder type midfield player. I think this season he's been, he arrives in the box at perfect times and he scores different types of goals. He got the two headers against Chelsea. He can score right foot, left foot. And he does remind me a bit of Lampard, and he's... he's one that's, you're getting a lot of goals out of a 20-year-old. He probably is, Spurs are over-reliant on him at this stage just because there isn't really any more goal scorers in that side apart from him and Kane.
And he doesn't take penalties, which Lampard did very well, we might add. Rory, Crystal Palace versus Sunderland, a six-pointer. Yeah. More?
Oh, this is
12-pointer? How many points is this worth?
They can go into 15th place, which is good for them. I think Palace they thought they were going to get this manager to come and save them from relegation. It didn't quite look like that at the beginning. But now they've done quite well on the transfer market. They've actually got Benteke scoring, Zahar. It's all coming together. He's back now. I think other than Jordan March, a big loss. No, I'm joking. They've pretty much have a good window and. Happily going to see it out. I think
Sacco's a very good signing for them.
Sacco's good, exactly. He probably could save it for them like single-handedly. But and also they're coming this weekend. Swansea going to lose. Middlesbrough are probably going to lose. Let's be honest. and then Leicester. United could beat Leicester, so they could happily jump a couple of places out of the relegation zone.
Yeah, Adrian. Both managers in this game have. Been to hell and back over the past couple of years, haven't they? Well, they've been to heaven and back, more regardedly. Moyes to United, Big Sam to England, and now they're both finding themselves in a proper relegation scrap. It's a bit odd because you go back 10 years and these were two of the hottest prospects in British management, both being touted for big jobs, and now they're really having to scrap it out. But it's something that they're both strangely suited to at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, Allardyce certainly is. If you look at the two, you'd probably back Allardyce to be the one who's actually going to get out of the trouble that the Heath side are currently in. I mean, the win on Tuesday at Bournemouth great foundation for Allardyce to now build on. Mm. It was a proper Allardyce performance, you know, really resilient, hardworking, organised. Wasn't pretty, but they won. Goal coming from a set piece, the first one, second on the counter-attack. And I think for, you know, Allardyce, you expected him to have an instant impact at Crystal Palace. It's taken a little while, but there were the first signs on Tuesday night that those little things that he's been trying to do certainly make them more organised and tighter at the back.
Mm.
That's now starting to work. He's obviously got a few more players to chuck into the mix now as well with his January signings. So I think now Palace will be fine. I expect them to win at Sunderland.
Okay.
Against Sunderland. Sorry, it's not at Sunderland because I'm going. It's Selhurst Park.
All right.
Yeah. I'm certainly not going up to the stadium. Yeah. Like,
no way.
So, yeah, I'd expect Palace to win that quite comfortably and get continue their momentum from Tuesday night.
Ollie, what do you reckon are the main battles to keep an eye on? I mean, obviously, the funny thing when you see these games is that both squads have obvious weaknesses and generally they rely on one or two players to make things happen. What should we be keeping an eye on?
Well, with Sunderland, the only threat really is Defoe. We talk about him every week with Sunderland, but that's because there isn't really anyone else.
It is Groundhog Day.
Yeah. I think it was last season where Sunderland got a snatch and grab at Selhurst Park and Defoe scored after a mix-up with Hennessy and Scott Dan, I think. So he's their only threat. I don't know if Sacco probably won't be ready to play. But I think, yeah, the thing with Palace is, you know, Allardyce, as Adrian said, had a sticky start. He usually comes in and has a great start at these clubs, but he had a sticky start. He inherited a squad that I think was built towards passing the ball, getting out wide and getting crosses in, whereas he is, you know, he's a more direct manager.
Mm.
And you look at his signings, he's got Sacco, a big powerful defender. He's got a big, powerful Serbian midfielder who I can't pronounce his name,
okay,
from Olympiakos.
Danilo or something. Yeah,
yeah. He's building the squad around his strengths, so I think they'll be all right.
Okay. One last game to preview: Watford versus Burnley. Rory, a thriller.
Yes.
A team in woeful form, bar that Arsenal win, versus a team with the worst away record in the league, pretty much.
But that was the big surprise, that what they managed against Arsenal, and it was kind of thanks, the courtesy of Niang, who himself hadn't really had a great spell with Milan, and they were quite happy to see him go off. But yeah, he looked pacey, he just basically went straight hell for leather against Arsenal's back four all game pretty much until he came off. It did take about 2 minutes to get off, mind. But yeah, I think he was good, and also, you know, you've got players like Deeney who really bossed around the Arsenal back four again as well. So him and Niang maybe together could save Watford. I mean, they're comfortable kind of mid-table now, but there's still a lot of opportunity for players, other teams to catch up. So maybe that's the... And also Kapuwe as well.
He's very good.
Yeah. I think he can comfortably... Yeah, I mean, Burnley's midfield is looking okay. But Hendrick as well and Defoe. But I think Kapuwe is probably the best bet there.
Okay, yeah. We agree with that. Ollie, Adrian, agree with Watford?
I was just going to say, I bet this game's a cracker because sometimes, you know, you look at the fixture list and you just think, oh, God, this game's going to be terrible. Mm. And they're the ones that always turn out to be great games. So I reckon there's going to be loads of goals in this one.
Okay.
Just based on that weird reverseness. Thrill.
Thrill? Okay. Yeah. Thrill. Yeah. Fair enough. Now it's time for Would You Rather. We play this every Friday. I ask our panel a series of questions with two possible answers, and they give me their honest assessment. The first question is, panel, Gabriel Jesus or Sergio Aguero? I'm coming to Ollie first. You're Pep Guardiola. You're bald. You're 42. You've won countless titles, Champions Leagues. You're trying to introduce a new... What do you do? Gabriel Jesus or Sergio Aguero? You don't have to be Pep Guardiola.
I think for now, just Aguero, just because he's still top class. He's in the peak years of his career. And as good as Gabriel Jesus looks, he's got, you know, plenty of years ahead of him. So just Sergio Aguero.
Okay. Adrian?
I'm going Aguero too. I don't want to be accused of getting blinded by the new kid on the block. Mm. So I'm going to go with Aguero and everything he's done in England so far. Mm. For those reasons.
Yeah. Adrian and Ollie are being loyal. To pedigree. Yeah.
Meanwhile, I've been blinded, and I'm going to go with the new kid on the block. Why change a thing that's kind of really working at the moment? But yeah, having Aguero off the bench, that's not a bad option. No. So yeah, Jesus. Yeah.
Mm. Very interestingly, Squawker Bet are offering 2-1 for Gabriel Jesus to score more goals than Aguero from now until the end of the season.
Mm.
Not bad.
Yeah, and you know he's a real kid to watch, and I think he's gonna kind of take over that mantle that Iheanacho had, beginning so clinical. obviously when he came on against Spurs, it was offside, but that's, you know, that's pretty much two and two now. So, you know, definitely one to score.
You mentioned his assists so far as well. It's interesting how involved he is in sort of creating as well. Aguero is obviously more renowned for just his finishing. So, you know, if Guardiola's looking for a unit and those front three to work as a team, you're going to get more out of Jesus. But I'm still sticking with Aguero.
Okay.
Despite talking up Gabriel Jesus.
If you do think Gabriel Jesus is going to outscore Aguero, you can just Google Squawkabet and you can use the sign-up code POD for a £10 free bet. No strings attached. Bet 10 quid, get 20 back.
I'm going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah? You going to do it?
I'm blinded. I'm going to do it.
Oh, he's blinded. He's blinded by the lights. Next one, very topical. Frank Lampard's retired today. Obviously, we mentioned it earlier. But Ollie, I want to know, not as a player, but who would you pick to be a manager out of Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard? Who would you rather as manager, Lampard or Gerrard?
I think I'd probably just go with Lampard, just based on, you know, he sounds very switched on. He sounds very knowledgeable when he talks about football. And he knows Latin, which is nice and cool.
Definitely.
Why is that bandied around as well? As the proof of ultimate intelligence? Has Frank Lampard got a GCSE in Latin?
Yeah, I don't know. Just as a player as well. As a player, PDM. I think he was a bit more disciplined as a player, and maybe more tactically aware. So maybe just Lampard.
Okay, Adrian, Lampard or Gerrard? Bear in mind, Gerrard is currently in the coaching setup at Liverpool.
I'm going to go Lampard for similar reasons. Actually, just having been fortunate enough to do a couple of interviews with Lampard and be in those group situations where he's holding court, very articulate, gets his point across very well, talks very well about the game. So on that basis, it's always stuck in my mind, actually. He's only been a couple of times I've interviewed him, but it's really stuck. It's one thing that I've come away from the situation and
he seems
really
to command the room quite easily. Rory, Lampard or Gerrard? Lampard was never really... He was sort of vice captain to John Terry's ultimate leadership. Gerrard was such a leader for Liverpool.
If you're thinking about a leader, it's probably got to be Stephen here. So... Yes, Stefan Gerrard, I will go for.
Steven Gerrard?
Yes. Yeah. I just think if you're a youngster, then he's going to give you a lot. So much experience. Yes, he hasn't won as many as Lampard, but I don't know, that passion, there's more drive, there's more sort of hunger. I mean, it's not saying that Lampard has not been hungry to succeed in his career, but I think there's a sort of rawness to Gerrard that probably Lampard wouldn't. Lampard probably a bit more reserved as a manager. I think... To really get the best out of your players, you know, you saw what he did in that season where Liverpool nearly won the title. He pretty much took on the role of the manager on the pitch at times. So yeah, perhaps go for that reason.
Okay, I'm going to come straight back at you with the final one.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah, Emil Heskey. Yeah. Or Peter Crouch, which would you rather?
Well, there's no neither option
at there. Emil Heskey's got 110 Premier League goals in his career. Yeah. Peter Crouch has just got the 100 at their peak. Or
it's got to be Crouch, I think.
You're going for Crouch?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's got the acrobatics. I know. Heskey did manage one at Newcastle Jets. I think it was quite
some, bicycle cave.
Yeah, I think it was pretty good. But no, I just think Crouch. Yeah, for me. Yeah.
Adrian,
at their peak, I'm going to go Heskey.
This is what I'm saying.
Because Heskey...
This is what I'm saying. We were asking this around the office earlier, man, and people forget how good Emil Heskey
was.
Yeah,
I was going to say, you know, when he first broke through. And when he was at his peak, Heskey was, you look at the size of him, the pace, the power. Mm. Yeah, good luck trying to stop him at his peak. So I'm going to go Heskey.
Yeah. Ollie?
Heskey, as Adrian said, was very good in his peak. Brilliant link man as a striker for the likes of Owen. But I'm going to go with Crouch as well. I think he's got more to his game. He's came up with crucial goals. I like strikers that score goals, and Heskey doesn't do it enough.
Okay. He's permanently at the peak. I mean, the size of him, really. He's basically a summit himself.
He's always at his own summit. Yeah. So that's Aguero, Lampard, and Crouch. That's interesting dinner party. We're going to finish off by asking the pod what is the one game that they feel you need to watch around Europe this weekend. So everyone's, you know, thinking about their weekend. They've got various little things to do. They're planning playing football, playing five-a-side maybe, but you know, you want to watch some football as well, and not just Premier League football. What's the one game around Europe, Ollie, that our listeners have got to watch this weekend?
I'm going to go over to Germany, to the Bundesliga, for Dortmund against Leipzig.
Are you actually going?
I wish I was, unfortunately not. I think it's on at 5:30 on Saturday, so it should be on TV.
That's a nice time for to watch a game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Two of the sort of, you know, up-and-coming young teams in Europe. They're both blessed with outstanding young talent. And Dortmund need a win, really. They're sort of cut adrift from the top four at the moment, which obviously Leipzig are in, so should be a good game.
Adrian, one to watch around Europe?
I'm going for Monaco-Nice Saturday afternoon, which is a top two in France. Both level on points. It's obviously a slightly different look to the top of the French league this year because of these two. You know, PSG in third. Monaco scoring goals for fun. Nice with Balotelli up top. So just, you know, I saw it scanning the fixtures. I saw that one and I just thought, yep, let's see how that one turns out.
It's going to be an entertaining game with the way that Monaco attack. Lamar, Silva, Falcao. Rory, what's your game to watch around Europe this weekend?
Obviously there is Dragon's Den on, but you could probably catch that after. No, you couldn't. So there's Juventus, Inter Milan, 7:45, Sunday evening. Buckle up. I think Juve, you know, the top, it's kind of same old for them, but they've got such exciting talent like Dybala coming through. I mean, Inter Milan still sort of scrapping about.
They're on a good run, though, at the moment.
Yeah, Icardi's scoring, you know, for fun still, you know, after his debacle with the ultras and all that kind of settled down. So, you know, also, he was kind of muted to go to China. I know his wife / agent / sort of spokesperson.
His wife's his agent?
Yeah, one denari, yeah.
That's rare.
So she was talking up Chinese interest as well. You know, she's talking about Premier League interest in the past as well, but there's nothing come to it. They're definitely going to have to keep him. They've lost Ranocchia, which is no sort of real omission to Hull. So I don't think, that as a match kind of shouts out to me as a real battle, that one.
Could be interesting to watch. Well, that's all we've got time for. Please make sure you catch that game around Europe. Thanks very much to our guests, Oliver Young-Miles. Thanks,
cheers, Ollie. Nick. It's been fun as always.
Yeah, it's fun. Daily Mirror journalist, football journalist, Adrian Kajumba. Thanks again for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me again.
No worries. And Rory Briggs, thanks for having.
Thanks. Absolute pleasure, as sometimes is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks very much for listening. Please follow us on Twitter @Squawker and subscribe to the Squawker Talker on iTunes. We'll be back again with the Monday Squawker Talker. Greg Johnson, who's recovered from his man flu, will be back to take you through the weekend's action from around Europe. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.